right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Time to switch our focus over to the precious metals as we're chatting with Jeff Christian. Jeff is the managing partner at the CPM Group. And Jeff, I want to start off with gold, but we will get to silver as well. And it's actually a lot of the same topics we're going to cover here. But first and foremost, gold looked at as a safe haven. And as we talked about a whole lot in the first couple segments, war in Iran is continuing. The oil price is moving higher. The gold price not moving higher, though. It's more or less just consolidating sideways. As we're recording this, right around the $5,000 level, it is off of its highs of 5,600, but also off of its lows a couple days after that 5,600 was hit, of 4,400, more or less right in the middle of, I guess, this wide range. So, Jeff, big picture, why is gold not going up when we have a war going on in the Middle East that doesn't seem like it's ending anytime soon?
I think the simplest explanation is often the right one. The simplest explanation is that gold had already risen in anticipation of the war and an ongoing worsening of the risks and uncertainties that the world is facing, not only with Iran and with oil supplies, but, you know, across a whole spectrum of things. And no one should have been surprised. The Iranians certainly were not surprised when the United States and Israel attacked them, you know, because, you know, the United States has been saying they want to attack them for 40 years. And they have been much more militant about that. I mean, Dick Cheney wanted to drop a bunker buster on them in the final years of the George W. Bush administration, as did certain people within the Israeli Air Force, but cooler heads, including George W. Bush, prevailed. But, you know, since Trump has gotten back in power, he's been saying he's going to do this. They bombed it you had the so-called 12-day war where Israel and the United States bombed various sites in Iran. That was clearly ineffective despite what the Trump administration said. So now they're going back to do more, and they're ignoring everybody's calmer heads and wisdom and say, you know, so now we've got the Straits of Hormuz closed. But I think getting back to it, the gold price had already risen to $5,500, you know, and that was partly reflecting the fact that everyone assumed that the United States was going to attack Iran. Yeah. So the price, you know, and to be honest, the price of gold for the first time ever crossed $4,000 in like October of last year. So the idea that the price went from $4,000 to $5,500 and now it's trading basically around $5,000, the gold price already anticipated that war. That's really, I think that's the simplest and most logical explanation for why gold prices haven't risen even further.
Well, Jeff, we'll even dig into the nuances here. You just did a good piece and did a video on this topic about gold and oil and the correlation not being nearly as tight as many investors assume, and even in times of geopolitics. I think a lot of people figured there was some of it priced in, but then when the war has taken longer and it's extended, they expect it to keep moving higher. But maybe unpack some of the data you just shared with your members about the correlation between precious metals and oil not being that strong.
You know, there are fundamental reasons why gold and oil should move broadly together. And broadly, they do. But, you know, and those reasons are that when the oil price rises, oil exporting countries have a lot of excess cash coming in and they're very profitable. And a lot of those countries, Middle Eastern oil exporting countries, Russia, they have a proclivity to storing their wealth in gold and silver. So when the price of gold rises, they have more money to buy more gold. So there should be there. In addition to that, when the oil price rises, it has inflationary implications for the industrialized world, and it sucks money out of other expenditures and investments. So it tends to lead to lower economic growth, weaker stock markets, weaker bond markets, and higher inflation, all of which lead other people in other parts of the world, the industrialized world, to buy gold as a portfolio diversifier. So there are real reasons to do that, but they don't move in lockstep together. On a nominal basis, the correlation between monthly or quarterly gold and oil price changes is around 21%. On an inflation-adjusted basis, it goes up to about 40%. But again, it's not tick for tick. It's not dollar for dollar. There's a correlation. But I think that ultimately the big explanation is that gold prices anticipated what we're seeing.
So, Jeff, the one comment that everyone's making is that these higher energy prices, they are going to filter through to inflation. You brought up inflation there. What's a reasonable time frame to see this trickle-down effect of these higher prices into the inflation data? And then, who knows, maybe traders trading off of that.
Probably over the next 2 quarters. I would say 3 to 6 months is a period of time where you would see higher oil prices reflected in the higher costs of a variety of goods and some services. Big transportation costs, higher production costs. I mean, energy costs are the second largest component in mining costs after labor. So you're going to see higher costs for just about everything that you manufacture or that you transport, including, agricultural products. If you're shipping soybeans from Canada to China, you're going to put it on a ship, and that's going to burn a lot of bunker fuel to get that soybeans to China. So I think within 3 to 6 months, you see the inflationary implications of higher oil prices. And then the bigger question is how high do oil prices stay and how long do they stay high? And that's a more complex question. I do not believe that you're going to see the oil price plunge back down to where it was, 6 months ago or 3 months ago, $70 or something like that. I think you're going to see higher oil prices for a more sustained basis.
Yeah, Jeff, we've had a couple other commentators on the show make the same point that probably not going back to the low 60s anytime soon, but maybe some of it will ease off over the fullness of time. The other question is, if there's still this geopolitical price built into the gold price, what happens if the situation does get resolved? How much of the war premium comes out in a truce or a deal?
In the gold price or the oil price?
In the gold, well, I think in both, but more particularly in the gold price, how much of that premium is still held in there? Is that what's holding it at 5,000?
Well, I think that, the war with Iran is very problematic, but it is actually probably a small part of the overall risks and uncertainties that the world is facing. And you, in addition to that, you see, even within the context of the Iran war, you see the Trump administration getting rid of sanctions on Russian oil, giving, in essence, a big boost to the Russian government treasury to finance the ongoing war in Ukraine. They also are talking, they are petition, the Trump Department of Justice wants to drop the charges on a Russian spy. So you have a whole lot of problems that are going to continue even if this war were to end. First off, I don't see the war ending. For Mr. Trump to say that this war is going to be over quickly is reminiscent of Putin saying, "Oh, we'll be able to take over all of Ukraine in 6 days," or Brezhnev saying, the Russian and Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in December 1979 is a short-term military occupation. It lasted a decade, and it literally was the single most important factor destroying the Soviet government. All of those troops coming home hopped up on heroin and opium. And the dissolution that they and their families had, that was probably the biggest factor that led to the collapse of the Soviet Union. And then you also have the United States invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq. And Iran is the biggest and best armed country within the Gulf region. So I don't see this thing ending anytime soon. So I think it's going to continue to be a problem. What the war premium is in gold, maybe it's $100,000, $500 to $1,000. It's hard to say because there's so many other problems, from debt and deficits to lower employment and weaker economics to higher inflation. There's so many other problems that are behind the 5-year gold bull market that we've seen. I don't see that the resolution of this war would have a major negative effect on the gold price. You take off $1,000 off the gold price, you're back to where we were in January.
Yeah, that's the crazy thing about how fast gold has moved. And yeah, the world, in all fairness, it does seem like a mess. There's a war in the Middle East. There's the ongoing war in Europe over Ukraine. Mexico, we just keep getting bad stories about there. And that's not really a government thing, but that is cartels fighting with each other. It's a very scary world out there. And look, the gold price has clearly shot up. It went almost vertical last year. And look, you said a 5-year bull market. People can go the whole way back to over 10 years ago when gold was just at $1,000. But I want to ask you, in terms of investment demand, what are you seeing out here? Because look, gold is consolidating sideways. The stocks, those are having a very tough month. As we're recording this, GDX is off almost 20%, and it is almost back to where it started this year when you consider just how well the stocks did in January as a follow-through for all of last year as well. It does seem like we've lost a lot of momentum, and there was a lot of momentum behind the gold and gold stock trade last year and even the first month of this year. Where do we stand now in terms of who's playing this market, or quite simply, how many people have turned away and are sitting on the sidelines?
Yeah, I'm going to say something that will confound certain people. And it has to do with time. One of the things that we've seen right now over the last couple of weeks is we have been seeing some investors take profits from recent short-term investments. And the gold price surge that you talked about, and that I talked about, really, starting in October, November, December, January, and continuing, that was fueled by a combination of long-term traditional gold investors and silver investors, and an influx of non-traditional short-term opportunistic investors, people who poured into the gold ETFs and the futures and options markets, and buying some physical metal. And what we're seeing is a lot of those shorter-term people are taking profits or standing aside. And a lot of the longer-term people are also standing aside. They're not continuing to buy. They're waiting to see how low prices might go. So we wouldn't be surprised to see the gold price and silver price fall over the next week or so. And if that happens, we expect some of those long-term investors to come back in as buyers. But one of the things that you're seeing on an ultra short-term basis is, yeah, you have some investors taking profits, and you have a lot of other investors standing aside, waiting for lower prices to re-enter the market. Now, that's the ultra short-term. On a longer-term basis, there are all these other investors who are saying, yeah, as we were just talking about, massive risks and uncertainties, incredible levels of investor and consumer and business executive and government anxieties. So you've got a long-term situation that suggests that the gold price will continue to be high and probably rise further. And our expectation is that investment demand will rise further this year and next year from where it was last year. But on the ultra short term view, you could see a pullback before you see that renewed surge in investor demand.
Well, Jeff, let's carry this over into silver. Just like gold is hovering around 5,000, silver went on a rocket ship ride to 121 on the futures, dropped down to almost $64 on the futures, has settled out somewhere in between that range, really hovering on either side of 80, in the high 70s or the low 80s. What do you make of this price? Does it need to drop down to bring in that buying just like gold? Where are we at with silver?
I think it's a very similar thing. You've got long-term positive, for silver price and investment demand. Long-term, you've got a lot of negative economic and political factors that are keeping investors interested in it. But short-term, you have some profit-taking. You have lower fabrication demand, actually, for both gold and jewelry and in silver in a number of applications because of the higher prices, because of the economic uncertainties. And then you also have some technical factors. So you're seeing investors being much more cautious, really, actually, starting in January for silver. Even as the silver price was rising, you saw like ETF selling. So investors were selling silver ETFs in January, even as they were buying gold ETFs. But that has kind of reversed now. So you've got investors sort of thinking that, yeah, the silver price probably has to come back off, maybe to $70, maybe even lower. And then we would expect to see bargain hunting resume because longer term, the economic environment and political environment suggest that you should have more of your wealth in gold and silver than you used to.
No, we've definitely heard a lot of well-known investors actually start to say that and reallocate some of their portfolios to that. But Jeff, on the whole, I guess risk-free value of silver because of its industrial uses and because, well, it just seems to be a smaller market. It can go vertical and it can also come crashing back down. Silver production is also very much a byproduct of a lot of different minds. How do we even put a number on what the risk-free silver price of silver is, or even what the general cost of production of silver is?
Yeah, we calculate a theoretical risk-free price for gold and for silver. And they're theoretical because, I've only been in the business for half a century and I've never actually seen a risk-free environment. I've seen environments where the risks were extremely low or investor perceptions of the risks were extremely low. So with silver, from 1990 through 2005, the silver price basically traded between $3.50 and $5.50 an ounce. Now, that was sort of a risk-free price back then. If I look at the silver price today, the average cost of production for primary silver is around $11 on a cash cost basis. On a fold-in basis, it's probably around $20 an ounce. Now, that's only accounting for about 28% of mine production. The other 72% is byproduct, and depending on how the producers do their accounting, you can argue that a lot of that byproduct has a production cost, fold-in production cost of, $2, $3 an ounce. So mine production is very cheap. Very low compared to where we are now. And so too is secondary recovery from scrap. So you can say, well, what's the risk-free silver price? And say, well, a risk-free silver price would be what is the price of silver that clears the market, supply and demand, if investors are not present in the market? They're not buying silver the way they have been the last 5 years, but they're also not selling silver the way they have from 1990 to 2005. And you can say, what's that risk-free price? And it's probably around $20 an ounce. So you have to think about the mine production, the marginal cost of production, which is the primary producers, all-in cost probably around $20 an ounce, and fabrication demand. At $20 an ounce, you'd see renewed fabrication demand. You'd see more people buying. You'd see more jewelers making silver jewelry. You'd see more people buying silver jewelry and silverware and silver statues and stuff. You'd also see more use of silver in architectural glass. You might see a further increase in silver use in solar panels, which have been the big growth story for silver fabrication demand over the last quarter century. But with the higher price, you're starting to see substitution and a reduced per unit use. You'd start seeing greater fabrication demand for silver, and you'd probably, see that. So the risk-free price of silver is probably around $20 or $25 an ounce.
Well, Jeff, that's a pretty big delta between $80 and let's say 25. So, where do you see pricing settling out? Because, like you say, it's never really totally risk-free. What's a fair price for silver then, somewhere between those two?
For me to say the silver price, for me to expect the silver price to fall back to something like that, I would have to be convinced that we'd have incredibly better economic and political situations. And I don't see that happening. I see the economic and political problems that really have been. It's not the last 4 years. It's not the last 8 years. It's the last 60 years. Yeah. And I see a market clearing price in an improved economic and political environment on the order of $45 to $50 an ounce, right? Maybe $55 as a nominal price and $50 or 45. $47 to $50 on a real inflation adjusted price. That's where I see the price shaking out over the next several years, assuming that we get into at least a cyclical improvement in the economy and the political environment. That would require a resolution of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. It would require a cooling off of the wars in the Middle East, which have really been going on since the late 1940s. It would require some reduction in the tensions in East Asia and Southeast Asia between China and all of its neighbors. Yeah. And it would require greater fiscal responsibility, not only on the part of the United States government, but on the part of other governments and on the part of consumers and industrial users, all of which comes down to higher interest rates. So, a better return on interest-bearing assets. So, it would have to be a much better economic and political environment for the price to fall as low as $55 an ounce.
Jeff, what was happening, let's say 11 years ago when gold was down at $1,000, $1,100, and we were hearing that the cost of production was higher than what the actual metals price was, but yet we kept seeing companies produce gold. Mines weren't just nonstop shut in, obviously, because it's hard to shut in a mine, but I know there are people that are always looking at the underlying cost of production for especially something like gold that isn't really used, and wondering and understanding that production costs do continue to rise, but the metals price has continued to rise. That when in history, or what does history tell us when the market price matches or is really close to the cost of production, which we're nowhere close to right now?
If you go back 11 years or whatever, my math is kind of screwy. But yeah, 2015 to 2018, the all-in sustaining costs on about 85% of world mine production were down around $900 to $1,000. And the market price did fall to like $1,080 or $1,040. So you still had, on average, profitable mining, but the profits, the margins had contracted to virtually nothing. And you saw mine production fall. You saw mining companies suspend, in some cases, totally suspend their exploration, their greenfield and brownfield exploration programs. You saw them slashing their overhead and their central office things. So you saw the cash costs hang up relatively high because they are stickier. But you saw the sustaining costs, the exploration, the mine development, the central office stuff. You saw those prices fall, those costs fall very sharply. But you still had a small profit. And it was such a small profit that you saw mine production fall. But that was at $1,000 an ounce. We're not there, and we're probably not going to be there for a long, long time, if ever.
Well, Jeff, there's such a delta now between the cost of production and where they're selling it for that these are the fattest margins the industry has ever seen. Now, with oil prices creeping higher, that's going to eat into it a little bit. But even if oil prices do creep into it, they're still the fattest margins anybody's ever seen. What does that mean as far as the ability to potentially step on the gas and produce more gold? There's a lot of companies we talk to racing to do a bulk sample or racing to get small scale production going. The big miners can lower their cutoff and bring stuff in that's been sterilized for a decade. What does that mean for an increase in production?
Yeah, if I always like to say in 1980, when the gold price spiked up to 850 and came down, it averaged like $612 an ounce. It was very funny because the major mining companies, and 72% of the world mine production came from South Africa at the time, the major producers said, "We cannot produce gold at these levels." And they were right. But the mine production of gold went from like 30 million ounces to about 70 million ounces over the next 10, 15 years. And all of that production, or virtually all of that production, came from companies that were not gold mining companies in 1980. Yeah. But with the gold price higher, I mean, you had gold production in the United States less than a million ounces in 1980. You had one major gold mine, Homestake Gold. One major mining company, Homestake Gold, in the United States. I think that Australian production was less than a million ounces. You had mining companies up on the ropes around the world, but you had a whole branch of new companies. As Peter Munk said, "I don't believe in gold, but I saw the margins that were there in 1980, 1981, and I said, I've got to get myself a gold mine." And he created Barrick Gold Mining, which became one of the largest gold mining companies within 18 years. And you had this tremendous growth in mine production from companies that were not gold miners in 1980. You are starting to see the beginning of that now again. And you will see mine production increase in the long run. It may take several years to start emerging, but it's there. And as you said, yeah, you'll see existing gold mining companies increase their production, revive some old mines. You'll see a lot of old mines that will be revived again. We've been looking at several companies that are picking up old gold mines and rehabilitating them. So I think that will continue, and you'll see new properties because there are enormous reserves and resources for gold and silver to be mined that can be profitably mined at prices much lower than we expect them to be over the next decade.
Oh, what a trend that has been. Going back to these old mines, trying to start them up, and even taking over some mines that, quite frankly, bankrupted other companies, now getting quite a bit of value in the market. One more question, though, Jeff. This weakness in some of the share prices, but still strong economics for the producers. A lot of the juniors and mid-tiers have come off. We even heard during some of the earnings calls from the major gold miners that they might start looking at M&A. Is this the time where we are going to see M&A from the majors pick up further down the food chain?
Well, first off, I'm optimistic about gold share prices and silver share prices for a lot of newer companies. The majors in the gold market have a big problem in that they always buy high. So when the gold price rises, I'll tell you an anecdote. Do we have time for an anecdote?
Lay it on me, Jeff.
The Barrick management in the mid-19s, in the, you know, they went to the Denver Gold Group and they gave a speech. They said, "We're going to spend $2 billion or something and buy back our hedges and we're going to be unhedged." I left the Denver Gold Group a day early because I wanted to come to New York, where the Canadian American Chamber of Commerce was honoring Peter Munk, who had created Barrick and had moved away from it. And at that luncheon in New York, somebody asked Peter, he said, "You created Barrick in 83, and it's now like one of the two largest gold mining companies in the world. But other people created like 30 some odd other gold mining companies, and they failed. Why did you succeed where they failed?" And Peter said, "They didn't fail. They were all successful mining companies. And in fact, over the last 20 years or 25 years, whatever it was, we have bought 27 of those mining companies. And we were able to do that because A, I don't believe in gold, and B, we hedged. So when the gold price would rise, we would put hedges in place. And I know personally that at one point they had about 10 or 12 years worth of production hedged at extremely good prices in ways that gave them blue sky if the price kept rising, but gave them protection against lower prices. But Peter said, we hedged, and those other companies would go to their banks, borrow as much money as they could at the higher gold prices, and then spend it buying other properties. And when the gold price fell, they were in financial straits, and we had these massive hedge profits that allowed us to buy them in their financial constraints. That I'm afraid will happen again. You have major gold mining companies that will buy high and through mergers and acquisitions at the top of the market. And that will result, yeah, that will continue. In silver, it's slightly different. I think that there are some silver companies, major silver companies, that wish somebody would buy them, but the larger diversified mining companies are not interested in buying silver mining companies at this point. So I think that it's a different situation in silver, but both in gold and silver, our view is that you look at the exploration, the pre-development, and the development, and the mid-tier companies. And the mid-tiers will do well because, as I said, the majors will come in at the top of the market and pay a high price to buy those mid-tiers to shore up their reserves.
All right, Jeff, we will wrap it up here. That was a lot to get through and very interesting to talk about this market that, look, I get still longer term, looks great, should be great, but right now going through a bit of a consolidation or a little weak period and the stock's struggling as well. We'll see when that all turns around, but there's just so much going on in the world right now that it's almost hard to make sense of it all. If you want to follow along with Jeff, just search CPM Group or click the links in the show notes on our website, podcast, or YouTube channel. All you have to do is search The KE Report, and that's where you can listen to this full weekend show, all our daily editorials and company updates from throughout the week. Everyone, thanks for tuning in to this weekend show. Jeff, thank you for your time, and I hope you all have a great rest of your weekend.
The Corlin Economics Report is produced for A.B. Corlin and Associates. Opinions expressed on this program are intended solely for the entertainment of our listeners, do not constitute investment advice, and are not necessarily those of this network, radio station, or our sponsors. Find out more about this program and today's guests by visiting www.kereport.com. For Al Corlin, this is Colleen Robbins. Join us again next week for the Corlin Economics Report.